Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. As always, I'm here with my producer, Jason DeFilippo. Several years ago when I was living in New York City, I met a guy that was an underground poker player. At first, I thought he was just a blowhard who'd had a bit too much whiskey and maybe got lost in his own tall tales. I later learned, through actual photographic evidence on his phone, that not only was everything he was saying likely true, but there was a lot more to the story, and this poker underworld that he'd been participating in was really something else. Fast forward to today, and I'm getting a look even deeper inside the world of underground poker and the ridiculousness that goes down during these elite games played by A-list athletes and celebrities with tens of millions of dollars changing hands all the time. Who better to hear it all from than Molly Bloom, the woman behind poker games so legendary that the name Molly's Game ended up not only being the codename of these high-stakes tables, but also the title of her best-selling book and a feature film by Aaron Sorkin. Today, Molly's going to take us behind the curtain and tell us what she's learned running games and running game on some of the wealthiest and most well-known people in the world, what types of psychology she used to control the games and the players in them, rapport secrets for generating trust with people who don't trust anyone, and how it all came crashing down. Lots of insight and excitement in this episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show here with Molly Bloom. And if you want to know how I managed to get all these great people on the show and manage my connections and relationships using systems and tiny habits, so check out Level 1. It's a free course that we have for you about networking, relationship development, maintaining these tiny habits in just a few minutes per day that will help you have people text you and say, hey, do you want to interview Molly Bloom, and send you a link? Because that's how most of this stuff seems to happen to me lately. That course is at advancedhumandynamics.com/level1. That's advancedhumandynamics.com/level1. All right, here's Molly Bloom. So you start a legendary poker game and you get involved at the most base of levels with some of the most famous people. And you saw their dirty laundry, and I think you were around when some of the dirty laundry was soiled, so to speak. You got a gun shoved in your mouth by a mobster, arrested by the FBI in a dramatic takedown reminiscent of any Hollywood movie. How the heck did a straight-A student and champion skier make that slide? I want to start from the beginning here with, like, the childhood, because everything that it happened when you were a kid kind of informs how the heck you ended up waking up one day, you know, getting your butt kicked by the Italian mob.
I agree with you, and I think those seeds were planted early on and just took a while to grow. I think that a huge factor here was that I was born with this hard-driving ambition and with this, from the get-go, need and desire to be significant and to be seen as significant. And unfortunately for me, I was born into a family with two brothers who were legitimate prodigies early on. So Jordan is
great name, by the way.
In the tradition of all Jordans, Jordan was a genius, bona fide genius. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he went on to be a Harvard educated cardiothoracic surgeon, but he just presented as a genius early on, beating my dad in chess, testing out of his classes and into mine. And Jeremy was an athletic prodigy. Jeremy was number one in the world at 19 years old in skiing. He's a two-time Olympian, and he got drafted fifth round to the Philadelphia Eagles. So starting with my dinner table, I was never the most talented or the smartest person in the room, combined with this deep need to be someone special. And so, you know, I kind of went out into the world feeling invisible, feeling like I want to matter. And I wanted to be an Olympic skier. That's the first thing I wanted to do. I didn't have the natural talent that my brother had. And on top of that, at 12 years old, I was diagnosed with scoliosis. I had to go in for this gnarly surgery where they fused the top 11 vertebrae together in my back, put two metal rods on the side. The doctor said I would never ski again. In a year, I was back on the slopes, you know, and then I made the US ski team, was third overall in North America, made it all the way to the Olympic qualifiers. Basically skied over a little stick and my ski pre-release 20 feet in the air, got really injured and had to quit. And, you know, I was in my last year at University of Colorado. I'd done extremely well on the LSATs. I had a 3.9 GPA and I was headed to sort of a future of law school and everything. And I just wanted to take a year off before becoming super serious again. And I went to LA and needed to get the first job that, you know, that I could, and got hired by this guy who was a pretty demanding boss. I was his personal assistant. He said, one day he said, I need you to serve drinks at my poker game. So I'm like, okay, great. You know, I Googled like what kind of music do poker players like to listen to and what do they eat?
Wow. Yeah, you're like super qualified for this position.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Very professional and sophisticated. And I actually made this embarrassing playlist with songs like The Gambler on it. And I bring my playlist and my cheese plate. And I'm thinking like, you know, the players are going to be these overgrown frat boys. But then Ben Affleck walks in the room and Leo DiCaprio and a politician that I, you know, was very well recognized, and heads of studios, heads of banks. And all of a sudden I had this light bulb moment that a young girl from Loveland, Colorado at 23 years old, doesn't get this opportunity to network with people like this. You know, this is a kind of a very strange and unusual opportunity. And I saw it as access to money and to power and to information. And, you know, I wanted to stay in the room for these reasons.
Yeah. I mean, you weren't wrong. You did. That is access to power, to money. Mm-hmm. I mean, just the fact that you're in the same room, it's kind of like,
right,
hey, I don't necessarily want to do this favor for this young lady, but I've been coming to this poker game for a few months,
right,
and she's probably seen something. So maybe I should just like stay on this person's good side and make the call. And I'm imagining the politician is Bernie Sanders. I know that's not the case, but I would love it if it were.
Oh, that game was too rich for Bernie's blood.
I think so. Yeah, I would love to think that Bernie has this side where he has a couple scotches and he's the instigator of all the crap.
Of like massive knows. Capitalism and debauchery.
Right, and he's like always the one who's like, yo, let's get some girls in here. And you're just like, oh, Bernie, come on, man, you're cut off.
Bernie, no, yeah, no, you can't do this. It's bad for you. It's bad look for you.
All right. So your boss, Reardon, by the way, who sounds like a horrible person, and you learn something from him. Like, he treats you like a piece of garbage, but he's a great kind of hustler in a way.
Yeah. I learned a lot about business. A lot of it was who I don't want to be in business, but a lot of it was these sort of lessons that I don't necessarily know if you learn getting an MBA. You know, it's sort of like you got to get out into the world and see how it operates and see the back end of deals and how people behave.
He actually put a lot of pressure on you and you developed some interesting tricks. One, which I think is kind of a dastardly effective tactic, is this lost reservation. He would come into the office and say like, hey, get me a reservation for the most impossible restaurant in the city tonight for four people. And you're just like, are you kidding? This place is booked up 3 months in advance. Can you tell us about this? Because this isn't like a pro tip. I think it's more like unethical life pro tip. But it's so interesting that anybody, I mean, you innovated this because you had to, or you were going to get your butt kicked by this jerk, right?
Right, right. So I would call the restaurant and I would say, hey, I'm just calling to confirm a reservation. It's for our 25th anniversary. We're flying in. We're so excited. I just want to make sure we're at a table by the window because I have this big, you know, bouquet of flowers coming, you know, just like building this whole thing up. And they're like, yeah, just a minute. And they search for the reservation that's not there. Right. And then you tug on their heartstrings and they think they messed up and then they magically find your reservation so they don't get in trouble.
Right. Like, oh, here it is. Of course. Because, and I thought this was uniquely brilliant because here's the amateur way. Hey, I'm just calling to confirm my reservation. Yeah, we don't have it. Oh, but I made it so long ago. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And you're just randomly calling beforehand to confirm it. Sometimes people do that, but mostly they don't. Yeah. But if you're like, hey, I just want to make sure we have a table by the window because it's a special occasion. And by the way, I'm going to have flowers. Do you have something that you can do with those?
Yeah.
Then they're like, oh, crap. That's so specifically legitimate. Right.
Right. Right. And also, I just kind of thought to myself, like, most of the people that are working at these restaurants are just like me. They're not these, like, sophisticated, important, you know, self-important people. They're just people. So I just need to figure out a way to kind of trick them or appeal to their humanity, you know, something like that.
Yeah. And you do a great job in the book about describing how absolutely ridiculous the Hollywood scene people are. And I used to live in Hollywood as well. So okay. I get the excessively flamboyant, pretentious stuff. And I train executive protection guys, so like bodyguard type people. So I hear and see myself some of the access, some of the things that these guys have access to. And it's a little bananas. And I really appreciated that about the book because I could tell that it wasn't fictionalized, that at least not that much. You anonymized people and things like that. But the mm-hmm. idea that you would walk into a store and have that sort of pretty woman experience where they're like, ugh, what do you want? Because you're like visibly more too poor to shop there. I was like, oh, I know that feeling when you walk in and the guy at the $2,000 wallet store is like, what do you even want? Why do I, I'm not even going to talk to you, right?
Yeah. And now we know, right, that they're acting like that because they got treated like that and they think that that's what flies, you know?
Right. Exactly.
And now you know how to circumvent it. But at that time, God, there's nothing like Hollywood to make you feel like you don't matter, you know?
Yes. Exactly. It's like the whole mission of that town is to make you feel like mm-hmm. crap and
make
have low
you
self-esteem.
Feel small. And if you're walking into it already kind of feeling like that, and I didn't see it the very first night, but over time, I saw the immense hold that this game had over these guys. And I was like, wow, if I can control this game, I can control these people. I don't have to be small and unimportant anymore. That was my 23-year-old like light bulb moment. You know, there was a couple of them. Like one of them was network, right? The other one was poker is my Trojan horse. Whatever I want to get into right now, I can infiltrate any subset of society by just inviting that person, that representative of that world. So like, you know, I wanted to invest in art. I invited art dealers. I wanted to learn about tech. I invited tech luminaries. Like it was such an incredible way to infiltrate. And then, you know, the last one, which was definitely more sort of born of childhood dynamic and kind of what we opened up with was, oh, I know how to get powerful. I just need to control and have power over this game because it has this incredible hold over these people.
I think the strategy to become indispensable to the players without being needy or obvious mm-hmm. about it is brilliant mm-hmm. because it would have been really easy for you to go, I have to be cool and friends with everyone and be really mm-hmm. fun. And then they're mm-hmm. like, ugh, this, you're girl number 7,000 trying too hard to get us to like her so that you have access to the scene. And
right.
You saw that and you didn't do that, right? You purposely did not go down that route, but you also didn't seem to overcompensate the other way where a lot of people would be like, I'm just going to pretend that I'm bored with all of you guys and then they'll chase me. And it's like, yep, seen that game too.
Yeah,
you balanced it really well. And if somebody finds themselves in a situation, let's say they're not running a poker game in an elite Hollywood situation, but let's say that they are the lowest man or woman on the totem pole and they get invited to their CEO's meetings and they're in the room, how would you take that skill set that you built and apply it to that type of situation?
Well, I think it's hard in a one-off because you can't do too much. You sort of have to blend in the beginning. But if you are consistently invited to these meetings or you find yourself more than one time, a couple times in this environment, because I think it's so important in the beginning to blend in and read it, you know? Mm-hmm. Because if you don't know the tempo, if you don't know the tone, it's going to come, you're not going to know like how it goes and it's going to come off as awkward. So I think you want to sort of blend in at first, read it, read the situation, figure out how you can start to solve problems that you aren't even asked to solve, figure out how you can put your head down, work harder than everyone else and come up with innovative solutions to these problems that other people aren't coming up with. And then the number one key, if you have some time in these rooms, God, just make people feel special. Honestly, like I think a sales force, building a brand, building a product, like anything that I've ever, you know, the movie industry, poker, you know, just all these different things, like figure out a way to work hard and make people feel special.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Molly Bloom. We'll be right back.
This episode is sponsored in part by The Great Courses Plus. Now, this is a sponsor that's been with us for a long time. They've got a lot of amazing stuff in there. I mean, there's thousands of lectures inside The Great Courses Plus. They've got a brand new fascinating course that explores philosophy, essentially, the philosophy of happiness and productivity in the workplace, how to build a thriving workplace, a leader's guide. Now, a lot of buzz going around about the workplace and happiness, and is your team happy? Are you going to be retaining people? It's a big problem here in Silicon Valley, staff's mental and physical health. The problem is a lot of leaders don't seem to care, and a lot of other leaders don't seem to get how to structure the work environment for this. And we see there's a massive ROI. Otherwise, you know, why would Google have sleep pods if people didn't need these kind of benefits, if there was no ROI for this, right? They wouldn't have put that slide in there.
That's half the fun of working in Silicon Valley, is you get toys.
That's right. And with the Great Courses Plus, you can stream this course, any of their other fascinating lectures. You can learn from top experts in anything that interests you, from finance to human behavior to history. There's languages, there's photography skills. They've got the Great Courses Plus app so you can listen. And we know you're going to dig the Great Courses Plus. There's a reason that this is a great fit for the Jordan Harbinger Show fam. So check out through our unlimited special URL. You can get a little first month free action. TheGreatCoursesPlus.com/Jordan. That's TheGreatCoursesPlus.com/Jordan.
Support for the Jordan Harbinger Show comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, America's premier home purchase lender.
Let's talk about buying a home. It can be one of the most important purchases that you'll ever make. But today's fluctuating interest rates can leave you with unexpected higher payments. In other words, you get kind of sniped by the interest rate, and that can turn a great experience into an anxious one. And that's why Quicken Loans created their exclusive power buying process. Here's how it works. They check your income, your assets, and your credit, and they give you a verified approval. This gives you the strength of a cash buyer, which makes your offer more attractive to sellers. And once verified, you qualify for their exclusive Rate Shield approval. And they'll lock in your interest rate for up to 90 days while you shop for your new home. Then once you've found the one, if rates have gone up, your rate stays the same. But if rates have gone down, you get to keep the new lower rate. So either way, you win, which is the kind of thinking you'd expect from America's largest mortgage lender.
To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/Jordan. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030. Don't forget, we have a worksheet for today's episode so you can make sure you solidify your understanding of the key takeaways from Molly Bloom. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. And thanks for listening and supporting the show. To learn more about our sponsors and get links to all the great discounts you just heard, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. If you'd like some tips on how to subscribe to the show, just go to jordanharbinger.com/subscribe. And now back to our show with Molly Bloom.
What are some of the ways in which you were able to make people feel special that you could throw? Let's say you're talking to someone's executive assistant. They're Elon's executive assistant. So now they're in rooms all over the place, but they're still a 29-year-old gal who just graduated 4 or 5 years ago. And now you're in this room with access. You're at least in the room. How do you make people feel special in a way that's appropriate and not just what people are envisioning right now, which is like being extra flirty or something
basic. Flirty is not the way to go. Again, I think you really have to read your room. I think if you spend enough time with these people, you're going to see ways in. Make sure everyone like is taken care of and everything. But like, I think a really important thing to do is to somehow procure a genuine curiosity about people. And like really actually want to know their story and not just the story that's out there. You know, listen, remember the names that they talk about, remember the names of their kids, remember the things that they're going through, become a really good, curious listener, and then, you know, retain information. It's always been incredible to me how far you can get in the world by just listening to people, because most people are trying to talk to everyone, you know, trying to talk about themselves, trying to get their agenda furthered. And I think if you learn how to be a good listener and you're A, you get to start retaining information. You get clues all over the place. And B, everybody wants someone that will just listen to them. You know, that's why people pay so much money for therapists. That's why, you know, people are out there like promoting themselves on social media. I don't care if someone has $1 billion or $1. Everybody wants to feel heard. Everybody wants to feel like they're important, like they matter. And, you know, a huge misconception is that people at that level with that fame and that fortune and everything, you know, that they don't need anyone to talk to or they don't want anyone to listen. And that's just not the truth, you know? But I think it's really important to figure out how to cultivate an authentic curiosity, because otherwise it's going to come off as an angle, as inauthentic. And generally, if you're dealing with people at the top, they're pretty smart and they can sniff that out. So that's why I think it's really important to like just figure out how to actually get curious about it.
I like that. I love the authentic curiosity angle. It works well when you're interviewing as well as when you're trying to ingratiate yourself with someone.
Because
the other side of that is the whole like kind of fake inquisitive or self-ingratiating where it's like, how did you become such a successful? It's like, look, ask questions that they're thinking about that are going to signal professionalism and signal that you've actually thought about the problem as well versus trying to get them to just talk about themselves because they've played that game by the time they're controlling hundreds of millions of dollars in assets. And what I thought was really interesting about some of the players, I mean, you've got in the book Tobey Maguire, which is weird because like he plays this like nice boy on Spider-Man, but he's just like a complete demon at the poker table and frankly otherwise, and like the cheapness and the quirks and him making everyone rent this card shuffler. It's like, this is a guy with millions of dollars. He brings a card shuffler and he's like, hey, we should use this machine, and everyone's like, fair enough, and he's like, yeah, it's gonna, you have to pay me to use it. I mean, what a just weird situation. And a lot of the people that join the table seem massively insecure, except And correct me where I'm wrong, Leonardo DiCaprio and Ben Affleck seem like they're comfortable in their own skin, at least according to the book. And a lot of the other guys do not.
I don't know if I would actually say that anybody in the poker game in that setting seemed comfortable in their own skin.
Really?
Mm-mm. But that was kind of shocking to me. And maybe it's the context, right? Maybe because it's this, you know, they're just walking in and they're getting ready to sit down and they've got adrenaline or anxiety or whatever. I don't know. Maybe it's the context. Maybe it's not. But actually, Matt Damon seemed pretty comfortable in his own skin because he didn't seem like he was trying to be anybody. He was like, this is a huge game. You know, and he only played once. And he was like, what the hell?
Yeah, he's probably like, I'm not so good at this. I could lose a lot of money here. I'm not trying to front.
It was just, you know, in so many ways, it was such an unreasonable room to be in.
Yeah, I think even those guys don't find themselves in the same room hanging out ever, right?
Yeah, and also there was just so much money at stake. And it was such a proving ground, you know?
Yeah, well, of course, especially with all these egos on the line and other people watching. And what is the most money you've seen someone lose in one night?
$100 million.
$100 million over the course of what period of time?
15 hours.
Okay, that's still, I don't even know why it matters, right? Like, oh, okay, well, that's only $8 million an hour or whatever.
There's no way to cut that number up and make it sane.
Right. Like even if you scaled that out over an entire lifetime, it's still like, oh my God, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
This is obviously, they didn't carry $100 million in cash. This is all done on the books, I assume. Yeah. And then how do you collect that?
You know, ultimately I became the bank for these games. Ultimately I vetted the players, I extended credit, and I covered if people didn't cover. So clearly, I wasn't going to guarantee $100 million. I didn't have $100 million.
Right.
So I guaranteed up to a certain number in the game. And then I sat them all down and I said, you guys, the game is collecting this first five, no matter what, right? And then you guys, the other 95 or whatever lunatic number you decide to go in for is between you, you know? Because otherwise, my game is just a Ponzi scheme, right? If I'm guaranteeing $100 million and I don't have $100 million, that's fraudulent. So I could only guarantee up to a certain number, you know, per game. I was managing risk and I was looking at it formulaically. And, you know, I really like was managing the economics of it. But, you know, if he didn't pay that night or if he didn't pay, you know, that week $5 million, then I would have to write that check.
That would have been, you must not have slept so well that night, I would imagine.
I don't know if I slept well the entire duration, but I will tell you what. I had a pretty decent insurance policy in that as long as I made sure that I had the best product, right? Like that I had the best game, that I had the game that you could get paid out no matter what. The credit was solid because that's not the case on the streets. You know, most of the game runners are playing. They're losing. You never know how much they're into for. So, and they're, most of the game runners were running Ponzi schemes in that they had to get paid in order to pay out. You know, so I had a fully capitalized game. I had no pros. Most of the guys would let in pros, you know, because they would pay their rake. Up until the last like 6 months, I had no rake. It was all based on tips. I would be very strategic about who I sat around the table because I knew there was 9 seats and I knew that this was more than a poker game. This was an opportunity to hobnob with people like, you know, professional athletes and big celebrities. And also it was a very vibrant and rich opportunity to do business. Movies got made at that table. Hedge funds got started. So as long as I had this product, this game that was so far above everything else, and as long as I really did my background on, are these people actually liquid? Can they pay these debts? They would always pay because there was no other place to play quite like my game. As long as I stayed on top of that, I didn't really get stiffed that often. I got stiffed so seldomly for how much credit I extended. It's pretty crazy.
Of course, because nobody wants to lose their rep. It's worth more to them than the money at that point.
Yeah, the social currency, right?
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, $100 million in 15 hours, approximately $1,850 per second.
Oh, good math.
Yeah, well, Jason did that. I didn't just sit there and do that in my head.
No, that's it. I need that stat, though. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, 1850 per second. I was like, oh, let's go up to the minute. And it was like $111,000 per minute.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can rock that if you want as well.
All right. Thank you guys.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm curious, who is the most generous tipper and who is the cheapest? Because I can already kind of predict, but I'm so curious.
My moral math in terms of who I named in the book were people that were already named in the press.
Of course. Yeah.
And so of those people, you know, the names we know and care about, and of those people that were named, Ben Affleck was a great tipper.
That's good to hear. And I can imagine that there's one guy who told you to bark like a seal in exchange for the tip. That wasn't very nice.
Classic, no, that wasn't.
Classic Tobey Maguire. It's so weird that he's mean. It's so weird being like watching comic movies that he's mean.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's like always this surprising thing where you see these people's public persona in such a scaled out way and you think you know who they are. And then you meet them and you're like, oh, wow, they're so different, you know?
Yeah, I would imagine that to be the case. I have met Matt Damon at a bar. He was super nice, so no surprise there.
He's just like a normal dude, or at least that's how he presents.
Sure, yeah. Well, he is an actor. Who knows? Who knows? Yeah. Right. But money brings out a lot of truth about people, brings out a lot of human nature. I'm wondering, what are some of the big truths that you learned running these games, especially when it comes to things like pride, fear, and ego?
Fear and ego were the biggest dream killers. In terms of like the reason that people lost the most money, fear is the most dominant force at a poker table. And it doesn't matter that these people have so much money. Most of them are in so much fear of losing money in front of people, how they're going to, you know, appear to the crowd. And it just motivates so many of their decisions. And you can see extremely smart people who absolutely know the game and who absolutely know the numbers make really terrible decisions. And it's something that really solidified this belief in me that if you want to be dangerous in business, if you want to be dangerous in life, if you want to become a better version of yourself in business, to do real work on fear. And, you know, I can tell you that my strategy has been meditation and it's been profound, but just to see how pervasive fear is at a poker table with, you know, people winning and losing money and negotiating and betting with each other and taking risk. Like it's insane. It's so destabilizing.
That is super interesting and not totally shocking though. Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
totally shocking.
It's so tied to identity, you know, I think, and survival. It's like in our limbic brain. I don't even think we fully process it.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's very limbic, right? It's limbic brain. It's lizard brain, if you will, where it's all tied. And so all these brilliant, smart people, and we've learned this on the show before, the smarter we are, the easier it is for us to rationalize emotions. So a really smart person will say, I'm not just being afraid for no reason. I'm being afraid because of all of these complex things that are going on in their conscious brain. But really, it's still that limbic system saying, I'm afraid. You're smart. Figure out a reason why I'm afraid, rather than I don't want to look dumb in front of all these actors. you know?
Totally. Yep.
So we've rationalized this, and then we believe our own stuff because we're intelligent. That intelligence got us there in the first place.
Yep, for sure.
And I realized, look, you always had to change the location of this game, a lot of security around it, a lot of mystery around it, which helped sort of sell the idea.
Oh, yeah.
How else did you use psychology to control the game and the logistics of the event itself?
Sure. So I'm a daughter of a psychologist and a very vocal psychologist. We processed a lot at the dinner table and I hated it. Now I'm glad we did. And I also came to this poker game and to this world. Innocent doesn't even cover it. I had no idea what I was doing or where I was. I was in the weeds, you know, but it almost worked for me because after I was at that first game, I went home and I was like, I want to be invited back next week, you know? And so I learned about poker for the first couple days and I learned the rules and the objectives and I became fluent in the language. And then I spent the next 6 months studying the players and asking myself, what's driving them? Right? Like, why do these guys, with their access to literally anyone and anything, why do they want to come to this dingy basement, play this game, you know? And starting to figure out and unravel that is what really enabled me to create something special. And there's a couple things. These guys didn't want things. They could buy all the things in the world. They wanted experiences. They wanted the fantasy. They wanted to walk into this room and feel like they were someone in somewhere else, like James Bond, you know? So I started to build on that fantasy. And I just kind of looked at what Vegas was doing. Palatial spreads, beautiful people, you know, memorizing their drink orders and their food orders and getting special pillows for them, whatever, a customized experience. The economics matter for fantasy. You know, I knew this game could sustain a bigger buy-in. It was hard for me to kind of figure out how big it could sustain, but raising the stakes from 10 to 50,000 certainly contributed to that. Staking celebrities in the game that weren't playing was a huge asset because this game, a lot about what this game and this fantasy and everything created was this mythology.
When you say staking, you mean like finding a celebrity connection who would never really come in and play on their own and be like, look, I'll give you the money. You just sit there and slowly lose it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or lose it as slowly as possible. And if you win, you can keep it, but like try to stay in the game for 4 hours.
Yeah. Because look, if you get a Leonardo DiCaprio there, who's not a poker player, you would never come and buy in on his own. If you get a Leo DiCaprio there, and also you've got this huge buy-in game, right? Everyone leaves, they get on the phone with their friends. They're like, I played with Leonardo DiCaprio and so lost $1.5 million. You know, and all of a sudden you've got all this, you know, this ripple effect and this game starts to generate this huge mist. It's shrouded in mystery, it's shrouded in prestige and it's at a secret location. And I think you got to think about it like you're a storyteller, right? And like people love to tell stories. People are so drawn to myths and stories and they love to feel like they're part of something or they have this information about this thing. And so focusing on not only the experience while they're there, but also the experience they get to have being part of this community and telling these stories and giving them fodder for their stories was something that was really important too.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Molly Bloom. We'll be right back after these messages.
This episode is also sponsored by Hover. Building your brand online has never been more important. You've heard us harp on this quite a bit. And you need to show the online community who you are and what you're passionate about, especially if you're floating between jobs, if you think you might be floating between jobs, if you're starting your own shop. Your online identity begins with your domain name. And Jason, you're kind of a domain addict, from what I understand.
I've been a domainer for, you know, well over 20 years now. At one point, I had thousands of them. So I've worked with every registrar in the world, which is why Hover is such a great thing in the universe right now, because it is hands down the best registrar I've ever worked with, period.
Like, what makes them different?
If you try and go and buy a domain at some of these other places, all it is upsell after upsell after upsell. They'll sell you just about everything except the domain. It's ridiculous. Hover, no upsells. You search for your domain. They give you hundreds of options, and then you pick what you want. You check out. You're done. It's amazing. That's what they do. They do domains.
What I like is they give you free privacy. Normally that's like $30 a year. And then it's like, do I really want my address free for everyone so that I can get spam from fake trademark companies? So they give you free privacy. There's, I think, like 400 plus domain name extensions. So they've all got, yes, they've got the .ninja and all that stuff. Don't get that one, though, you tool.
I actually just got a .productions, which nice. Is pretty cool.
That is kind of cool. They also care about their clients, you know, which I know shouldn't be noteworthy, but somehow is in this day and age. So they're great. They're a pleasure to deal with. Everybody that works there seems cool so far. I highly recommend it. Hover.com/Jordan. Get 10% off your first purchase. That's hover.com/Jordan to get 10% off. So go grab that domain you've been thinking about for 10 years.
Thanks for listening and supporting the show. Your support of our advertisers is what keeps us on the air. So to learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. And don't forget the worksheet for today's episode. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. And now for the conclusion of our interview with Molly Bloom.
And you know what I like that you did? Yes, you gave, you became concierge to the guys sending friggin' mm-hmm. purses to the hotel room so that they could give it to their wife for missing mm-hmm. the birthday dinner or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you also built real trust. There was a point in which you got, I don't know how it happened, you got your hands on like a sex tape from somebody or something like that. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. you ended up giving it to the guy as kind of a gift. And he's like, how much do you want for this? And you're just like, no, I'm not blackmailing you. I'm giving mm-hmm. you the copy. Keep your dick in your pants or whatever it yeah. was. And so that guy, you built trust with this guy. Instead of saying $100,000, he probably brought you millions of dollars in
sure.
game because he was like, oh my gosh, you didn't take advantage of me while you totally could have. You're a trustworthy person.
In my experience, right, when I leave money on the table to play a smart long game or to have integrity, I've never regretted it ever.
I like that. That's how I choose to play things as well. I'm always looking yeah. at long term because it's so easy to get tempted by something short term. And I always tell people if they lose something, like if you find out that, you know, you get an email in your inbox, like my friend borrowed $1,000 and now she's ghosting me. I'm like, you're welcome. You learned a cheap lesson. Imagine yeah. if you'd lent her something more than that you couldn't replace.
Yeah. I think like that's another great lesson is to actually, and this is something that has been really useful in putting my life back together, is to look at all of it like and own it. You know, I can't be angry at anybody that I got, that I'm a convicted felon and that all this craziness that happened. It was all my fault. You know what I mean? Like, it's all my fault. So, but there's liberation in that. And when you actually take a really rigorous, honest look at yourself and you own all your stuff, then you get to avoid it in the future. You get to make new mistakes, new fun mistakes, but you know, you get to start not walking into the same ones.
I think that the way that you learned to deal with not only powerful men, but with women actually was quite telling. I can't remember if I read this in the book or if it's just something I noticed, but you were able to sort of disarm other women by taking the lead and showcasing humility or vulnerability in a very strategic way. Can you speak to that?
Well, I mean, I've always like very much been a girl's girl. You know, I think when I was young, I saw how like young girls treated each other and how they're always like teaming up on each other. And I just didn't really like it. So the times that I would feel jealous, because I think everybody feels jealous, I really tried to work on those feelings and be on the same team and as opposed to like act on those feelings of jealousy and you know, comparison and whatever. And I really am a girl's girl and I really do care about women. And I really like wanted, you know, it's part of my life's work right now. And what I care about is empowering women. And I never like was about competing with them. You know, I was just more about like trying to become friends. And I don't even know if it's so much of a strategy as it is just kind of authentically who I am. And also I was kind of like, who are we competing for?
Right. You know yeah, what I mean? Exactly.
Like, I don't, you could keep these guys. Like,
yeah.
And no, some of them were great, but I'm just saying like, there's really no reason to not be friends.
Right. No, I like that. I like that. And I think a lot of people, especially in Hollywood circles, would not start off with, let's be cooperative about this and collaborate. They'd be like, oh, she's here. This is a scarcity thing. I got to get her out of here or make her look bad so that I'm the center of attention. I mean, that's very typically very Hollywood. Most people won't make the first move to disarm that. So I thought that was very strategic.
But I'm also so happy, sorry to interrupt, but I'm so happy not to be the center of attention.
Yeah, especially in this situation.
Right.
Yeah, at this point, so you're 27, you're running $2 million tables at the most exclusive hotels in Los Angeles. Did you ever feel like, okay, any minute now, they're going to find out I don't belong here and the whole thing's going to fall apart?
Oh my God, every second. First game to the last game.
How did you keep it together? I mean, I assume the guys were trying to throw you off your game a lot too, especially your old boss while he was around.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's probably a combination of luck and just diehard ambition. I am somebody like, I'm not very social. I don't like just to gratuitously socialize. I like to win. That's why, that's just in me. Like the other day, we were at this couple's dinner and they're like, okay, we're going to play a game to get to know each other. And like my heart starts pounding. You know what I mean? I like got very serious and, you know, ruined the game kind of because I won in like two moves. But I just like, I like to win. I'm ambitious. It's who I am. And so I spent almost all my time thinking about how to be successful at this. And so I probably got pretty lucky a lot of times. And then I just also really worked hard and really just tried to spend most of my time trying to figure it out.
I think this is admirable, especially because it wasn't just early success that you had. I mean, you did have that, but later on, this big fish, Arthur, at least that's his name in the book, screws you out of your game, basically decides, mm-hmm. we're having this at my house, takes a lot mm-hmm. of the clientele. This is near and dear to my heart because earlier this very year, I also got screwed out of my 11-year-old business in a lot of, I mean, I still own it, but I got kind of locked out of everything.
Oh, really?
And it's involved in like litigation back and forth. And it was with people I'd worked with for 11 years. So it sounds very familiar.
It's a heartbreaker.
It is. And it was. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you, I'll tell you in a minute what's going on. But when you had this happen, what's going through your head? Because for me, I kind of felt like, am I still the same person that I was because I lost this? So did you have this identity shift?
I was terrified. I thought that it meant I would go back to being an absolute no one. My entire identity was tied up in this. It was like I put everything I had into this thing, you know, and it felt like someone had taken me. And you're like so scared that without this, you have to go back to being someone's personal assistant, errand girl, you know, cocktail waitress, whatever. And then also, I felt like somebody like lit me on fire. I was so mad at the injustice of it. So it was the combination of terror at going back to being a, you know, quote unquote, no one. And then it was also anger, which in my life, I've been able to convert to fuel very effectively.
I think we had a very similar experience. I also went through, I want to say like, I kind of almost went through the 7 stages of grief or something like that. Uh-huh. I don't know if I went through all 7.
No, for sure.
But then you're like, people go, oh, you're going to be angry. It's going to dominate your life. And I was like, okay, warning taken. But I basically uh-huh. went, what I'm going to do is pack up, mm-hmm. go to a different type of thing that's similar enough, take my ball, go somewhere else and dominate mm-hmm. and crush
and make
it so obvious that this was a huge mistake that at some point everyone goes, what the hell were they thinking getting rid of him? And that's exactly what happened. We are now dominating the scene. Most of the audience has migrated to this new show. We're bigger than that old show ever was. The business that we're doing is much more fun and interesting. The whole team ended up coming with me. So it's like, you did the same thing.
That is awesome.
You packed up. You headed to New York City. You proceeded to make 3 times what you were making in LA without all the BS. So I was like, when I read that, I was like, sounds familiar.
Yeah, no, what you're describing is pretty much exactly how I felt. And I'm so happy that you're triumphing, that you've been triumphant. Like that lights me up. That makes me happy because it sucks, man.
It does. But I will say it's probably the best thing that's ever happened in my business.
Yeah. Yep. And that's the other part. And that's like, as you get older and more perspective, you start to see these earth-shattering events as, okay, well, maybe I can just be a little bit curious about this and see where it leads.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think and you can probably relate to this just as well, we get so tied up in what we had going that we think we could never start over. We could never do it again.
Exactly.
And then when you finally either have to, or you're going to be doing like retail at Gucci or whatever the hell the other option is, right? No offense to those people, but it's not exactly what we were doing.
Sure.
Then you start to think, well, wait a minute, not only can I do this, but now it's mine. Because before you were running Reardon's game mutated into Molly's game. Mm-hmm. Now, though, once you're completely free of all those constraints, you don't have power players being like, I'm going to take your game. It's like, no, this is my game. You're in my house.
Yep.
I'm not a guest who's doing a good job. I'm not your top employee. I'm running shit now, basically.
I'm the MF bank.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And the benefit of your industry, as you mentioned, you have access into any industry because every niche has gamblers in it. Sports, art, finance.
That's right.
How did you end up leveraging that network to get benefits in other ways? Like you mentioned investing in art, invite artists, but or art dealers. There's probably a lot more where that came from.
Yeah. A lot of it is information, right? So an education. That's what a lot of investing is, in tech stocks and in art deals. And the truth is that I would invite people, right, with all these well-intended, because I was always looking for, I was dishonestly looking for a way out, meaning I was saying like, okay, I'm going to pivot. And this is how I'm going to pivot. I'm going to pivot into the art world, or I'm going to pivot into real estate, or I'm going to pivot into tech. And so I would set up these opportunities for myself. And then I couldn't leave because I just, you know, I was just in this thing and this life that it created for me. So I didn't fully execute on the Trojan horse bit. It was a well-intended ploy to satisfy the smart part of my brain that was like, we need to do something else, you know?
Yeah. So you kind of lied to yourself and you're like, I'm just doing this so I can get a good connection in the art world and I'm going to become an art dealer. And that's like, just kidding. I made $300,000 last week. I'm not doing that crap.
Right. And like, you know, I got some like privately commissioned pieces by some artists and I've got some good intel and I made some good deals, but like I never fully acted on the intention.
That makes sense. Yeah. Cause you were kind of addicted to this, right? At this point.
I was addicted to it. Absolutely. Yeah.
I know you had other things that you were starting to slide into because there was a disconnect between who you really were and this business that you were running. And you started to sort of self-medicate with that during that, right?
Yeah. It was just so incredibly unsustainable and I had no partners. And, you know, when I'm guaranteeing the money, I can't just hand it off to somebody because if they make one accounting error, that's $250,000 that I've got to write the check for. So I just never slept. And I got really bad into drugs and alcohol. And part of it was in the beginning, probably to try to address the unsustainability and stay up and everything. But then it became this thing where it was like, I was so empty and my life was so empty. And I did it to numb myself after a while too.
It's kind of understandable. I know that you're sober now, so that's, I mean, we can easily talk about this kind of thing in a way that's probably a little less traumatizing. But before we get to the less traumatizing, let's keep going with traumatizing because you're involved in this craziness and you moved out to New York and then suddenly it's like, and when I read this, I was so surprised because your driver, who you were kind of like homeboys with, I mean, this is the guy who drives you home at 5 o'clock in the morning. You trust this guy. He's like, my friends want to meet you or something. How did the mob get involved? What's going on here?
Yeah, so apparently my driver knew them and said, but it was also shady because he said to me, I drive these guys from New Jersey. They're hedge fund guys. They want to play in your game. And so I said, okay, great. You know, have them meet me at the Four Seasons Bar on 57th. And they walked in and it was just, I mean, they stuck out like a sore thumb. You know, everyone after the bell, like at the Four Seasons uptown is like legitimate businessman, whatever. These guys rolled in. It looked like they just came off the set of Goodfellas. One of them had a bullet around their neck. Like it was, I'm sitting down with them and it was kind of funny actually, because to break the silent, awkward silence, I was like, well, can I get you guys something to drink? And they thought about it. They looked around the room and then both of them ordered apple teenies. And I'm like, whoa, it's not like the movies, huh? But then they got to their, you know, their business real quick, and they kind of gave me the spiel about how it's pretty incredible what I've been able to build and impressive, but this is their turf, and you know, they've been empowered to come offer me a partnership that's kind of not, you know, really an offer, but more of a demand, and that it could be fortuitous for me because they could collect for me. And, you know, basically they were saying like, you need to give us a piece of your operation and we're getting involved.
Right. Extortion. And then it's like, no, thanks. I'm good. People are paying for things already.
Yeah.
So were you kind of like naive? You're like, no, I'm good. Apple teeny. I'm fine.
Yeah. Well, of course, like I guess I had gotten a little too confident in my ability to navigate hard situations, and I wasn't fully aware of who I was dealing with. So I was just trying to use logic. I was like, look, I really appreciate the offer, and I also appreciate that this is the business you do, and I'll stay away from your areas of operation for sure. But if I partner with you, I'm going to lose every client I have, and we're going to be nowhere. You know, so I was like trying to reason, rationalize with them. The whole thing was super weird. And this happened to me a lot. Like, they were very confused that I was me, and I was very confused that they were them. So it was this like very disjointed conversation where I'm sure they're used to going through this script a million times, but it's usually with a guy. You know, it's not with like this 5'3" girl, you know, like 30-year-old girl. And then I was trying to talk to them, but I didn't know really like their culture. So it was just it was an awkward meeting.
Yeah, I can imagine. They were probably not surprised because I'm sure they knew who they were going to talk to, but they probably thought you'd be a little bit more. I mean, I don't know. Who knows what was going through those guys' head time?
I think that they thought I'd be like a little bit more street smart, probably maybe a little taller, older. I don't know. You know, they were just like, we just weren't expecting each other, and we didn't really know how to communicate.
Yeah. I can imagine. So how did this all start to end? Because I know that once you said no, they weren't like, oh, boss, she said no, let's find another victim. Yeah. I mean, how did this start to wind
that's
down?
Not what happened? I just kept evading their calls. And then around Christmas time, holiday time, it was 2010, I was waiting for a delivery from my doorman. And so when there was a knock at the door, I didn't even really think about it because I also had a very safe full service building in Manhattan. And the door opened and this guy that I'd never seen before pushed his way in and stuck a gun in my mouth for what seemed like, you know, an eternity. And then he beat the hell out of me and he robbed me. And he kind of gave me this speech about how the partnership wasn't optional. And if I told anyone about this, or if I didn't comply, then they would take a trip to Colorado to see my family.
Oh, that's so scary.
Yeah, it was really scary.
So what did you do then?
So I stayed in my house for 3 weeks and let my face heal. I didn't even go out. I mean, I just like ordered food, and you know, because if anyone saw me, it was really clear what had happened. And I was scared that, you know, at this point, I'm not only afraid for my life, I'm now realizing that I've put people that I really love in danger. And then after about 3 weeks, I got the New York Times and the big headline on the cover. This was, I think, mid-January. It was, it said 125 people arrested in the biggest mob-related takedown in New York City history. And I avoid, you know, they went away, but obviously this whole thing was coming off the rails.
Right. It was like, so the guys that were threatening you went away because they went to prison, but it doesn't mean that everyone's gone. And it doesn't mean that the next time somebody catches wind, they're not going to come after you hard.
Yeah, exactly. And then also I had recruited these guys, these whales. They were huge players, just a game runner's dream, until they weren't, because you know, I had private investigators. I had bank employees. There were so many people on my payroll to do background checks on people. And these guys, their story checked out, but it turns out that they were actually running this $100 million auto insurance fraud scheme. And the feds had been on to them for some time and they were listening to their phone. And then they started, you know, then they got on to me because, you know, we've got the guy that ran the Ponzi scheme on the West Coast that sued everyone in the game. Then we've got the Italian mob, the Russian mob now, and those guys that were running the insurance fraud scheme had deep ties to the Russian mob. And so like all these things are happening around me and it's all connected by me. And so then the feds got involved. And the first thing they did was they took all my money. I was worth millions and I had zero. And I had to move back home with my mom and kind of figure out how to rebuild a life. And, you know, we spoke to the feds. They said, we've decided that the way she made her money was illegal. If she wants to come in and talk to us, we can talk about giving the money back. But if she doesn't, then this is what it is. It's on the civil side of the prosecutor's office. And, you know, property doesn't have the presumption of innocence. And basically, I was just like, game over.
Yeah.
And we didn't hear from them. And my attorney at the time said, I guess they decided not to pursue it. So for 2 years, I started putting my life back together. I got sober. I got honest. I looked at myself. I started writing this book. And then 2 years, almost to the date, I moved back to LA. I'd gotten a pretty decent job. It took me 2 years to get a job. I was unhireable, yeah. But I got a job. And the book was finished. And 10 days later, I get a call in the middle of the night. This is Agent so-and-so from the FBI. You need to come out with your hands up. I walk into my hallway. When my eyes adjusted to the high beam flashlights, I saw 17 FBI agents, semi-automatic weapons pointed at me. They put me in jail. I had a day and a half to get to New York. On the press release, it said I was looking at 90 years. On the press release, it said it was a Russian mob indictment. I walked into this courtroom. It's all like Russian mobsters and their girlfriends. I don't know 80% of them. I have no idea, like this nightmare of what my life looks like.
The fact that you knew 20% though is probably a little bit disturbing of a statistic as well.
Well, the 20% was like, you know, the rich art dealer guy,
right?
Who just, it wasn't people like, it wasn't, it was the people, the crossover people.
Right. You know? It wasn't Slava the knuckle breaker. Right.
it wasn't the Vore.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Wow.
But like, it was just like overnight, my life became this unimaginable, illogical nightmare. Like I get, you know, if they would have said, hey, you and all your friends that ran poker games, right? But like all of a sudden I'm in a Russian mob indictment that's connected to this guy in Moscow who's known as the Vore, which is the most violent criminal in Russia. You know what I mean? And they're all these Russians are looking at me and I'm just like, I don't know who to be more afraid of, the government or, you know, this courtroom. Anyway, so. And then it turns out that the government, what they wanted from me is they wanted me to become a confidential informant. They figured that since I'd run these games for, you know, 6-8 years, that I knew secrets about the celebrities and the Wall Street guys and the politicians. And you know, they were right. I did. I did know things that could have potentially led to some, you know, some information for them on financial crimes or whatever. And they said that they would give me all my money back, and they said that they would drop the charges. And I had to think about that for a minute. And it just like, even though you think about it, right? Because it's a big decision to make.
Yeah.
It was so clear to me that I had made these choices. You know, I wasn't like, I didn't grow up poor. I didn't grow up like at a disadvantage. I grew up with all the opportunities in the whole world. And what I chose to do with it was run these high stakes poker games and ultimately break the law. And I needed to stand for those choices, you know, getting your money back and getting freedom doesn't mean anything if you hate yourself and you've decided that, you know, you've abandoned the things that you care about or like acted in a way that for the rest of your life lacks integrity and lacks courage. Like I just knew I couldn't do that and be okay with myself. So, I made that choice and I walked into federal court not knowing what the decision would be and, you know, really trying to mentally prepare myself on, you know, doing a little time and being okay with that. But how do you really prepare yourself for that? You know,
exactly.
But I got super lucky. I got a young judge. He was appointed by Obama and he was definitely super disappointed in what I had chosen to do with my life. But he said, I don't see how justice is served by sending you to jail. So, you know, at 33 years old, I didn't have to go to jail, but I'll tell you what, I had this moment where I was like, I'm 33 years old. I'm a convicted felon. I'm millions of dollars in debt. My reputation is destroyed. You know, like I need a massive rebranding campaign.
Yeah.
And I need like HarperCollins budget and Sony Studios budget for this massive marketing campaign. And the truth is I tried to get logical. And I said, you know, like any business that's in trouble, all right, are there any monetizable assets? What are the assets left? And I really believed that it was a unique story and that if it was told in the right way, it could create some opportunities for me. And so I was like, Mom and Dad, I have the perfect solution. I'm going to get HarperCollins to publish this book and I'm going to get Aaron Sorkin to write a movie. And they're like, when are you going to grow up?
Yeah, exactly. Like, why don't you get a job at Saks Fifth Avenue and yes. stop talking?
Yeah, they're like, just get a job. Like, just, you know. But I was in a good place, even though it doesn't seem like it. I was in a good place to go for it because I'd lost everything. I had nothing more to lose. I had spent my life so terrified of failure. And then I failed so spectacularly in, you know, in front of a large audience. And so I was just like, no, I believe in this. And I don't care how many people say no, I'm just going to keep I'm just going to not quit. And I kept asking everyone in Hollywood if I could get a meeting with Sorkin. And most people were like, yeah, I don't think he wants to write the movie about the poker princess. And or they would say, let me just give you some advice here. Do you know how many powerful people are trying to kill this project? It'll never get made. You're wasting your time. But I really believed in it. So I just kept at it. And finally, I got a meeting with Sorkin and I pitched to him. And then he kind of sat back in his chair and looked at me with this amused expression on his face. And he's like, right. He's like, I've never met someone so down in their luck and so full of themselves. And, you know, it's not full of yourself. It's just like, I here's my shot. Right.
Well, he was probably also like, so wait, we're going to make an ass out of who? Yeah. Sign me up. Maybe he was at one of your games and lost a hand and got, you know, Toby gloated in his face. And he was like, yes, I would love to make this movie.
No, his biggest fear, he was like, I will not dish on the celebrities. And I'm like, that's cool with me.
Yeah. So that's why you have these amalgamated characters in the movie that are like, I'm a blend of a bunch of people.
Yeah, I'm a composite.
Yeah, gotcha. Well, looking back at all of this, was there a part of you that ran the men's games? And you only mention men in the book, and you use the words men's games specifically, so I kind of assume these are all guys. Was mm-hmm. there a part of you that craved power over powerful men, maybe because of the way you were seeking your dad's approval growing up?
I think that that was definitely a part of it. And that was a part of it in my 20s. And, you know, that was a draw to it. But then, you know, the practical application of it, like after you start becoming the bank and you know, constantly having millions of dollars out on the street and constantly having to babysit egos and everything, you're like, this doesn't feel very powerful. This is a pain in the ass, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you're babysitting at that point.
Yeah, but what I did like and what I did realize, because when I grew up, we didn't have these conversations necessarily about being an entrepreneur in high school or whatever. It was more just like, you're good at math and science, you go this route. You're good at, you know, reading and writing, you go this route. And what I realized in those rooms is that I was an entrepreneur and that was my thing. And it really lit me up, you know, and so it evolved over time. And then, you know, ultimately what happened was, like you said, smart people can justify a lot of stuff in their head. I couldn't hide from anymore that I was using my entrepreneurial skills, my understanding of human psychology, my, you know, my creativity to exploit vice for my own gain. And that's something that started to really not sit with me well.
Molly, thank you so much. This has been really an awesome episode. You're a great storyteller. Of course, you're well practiced with this. And I love the insight into the psychology of how this all worked. And then, of course, later didn't work. But at least how you ran this, I think, is fascinating because we're all about the practicals here. And it's great that you can take kind of a, no pun intended, sober look at this past and go, here's what I did right and here's what I did wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you very much for your time and for coming on the show today.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you.
Great big thank you to Molly Bloom. The book title is Molly's Game. I told you this was a crazy story. I thought that she did a great job, super smart, obviously, really candid and not trying to front. That's what I appreciate about Molly Bloom, especially just she could easily sugarcoat this whole thing. Who knows? Maybe this is the toned down version. I'm sure it is. I can only imagine some of the things that she's seen during those games. And if you want to know how I managed to book all these great people and manage hundreds / thousands of relationships, I use systems and I use tiny habits. And I want to teach you how to do this for free. AdvancedHumanDynamics.com/level1. A lot of people are like, yeah, I'm going to do this soon. Or yeah, I'll do this eventually. Or I'm already a great networker. I've never met anybody that has all of these skills in one place. It took me years to put this stuff together. I don't know. I feel like people at the highest levels of business do more of these, but I've never met anyone that does all of them. So if you're thinking that you don't need this because you're a great networker, I invite you to learn, along with a bunch of other really great networkers, some of these same tactics. AdvancedHumanDynamics.com/level1. It's just a few minutes per day. No excuses. Get her done. AdvancedHumanDynamics.com/level1. And speaking of building relationships, tell me your number one takeaway here from Molly Bloom. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on both Twitter and Instagram. This show was produced in association with Podcast One, and this episode was co-produced by Jason Fullhouse DeFilippo and Jen Harbinger. Show notes are by Robert Fogarty. Worksheets by Caleb Bacon. And I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. The fee for the show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful. Hopefully that's in every episode. So please share the show with those you love and even those you don't. Lots more in the pipeline. Very excited to bring it to you. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen. And we'll see you next time.